God's View of Governing Institutions was presented by Jack Crabtree at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute, entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, the issue that we're interested in here this afternoon and the readings that you looked at, that was the primary focus of why those particular passages were picked. That the interest is, we here in America in the 21st century, if we are Bible-believing Christians and we believe the truth of the Bible, does the Bible have anything to say about how we should answer questions about how we as Americans should structure our life together, our government, our state, the way we conduct governance together? Is there a right way and a wrong way to do that? Is there a biblical and a non-biblical way to do that? Is there a godly and a non-godly way to do that? There are groups of people, and you can understand probably the logic of this, who, especially there's a group called the Theonomists, who have taken the perspective that God came to Israel in the Old Testament and he revealed to them his law. And if you look at that law has to do with, that covenant, has to do with all kinds of things. In fact, it's pretty totalitarian in a lot of ways. You have to eat this way, you have to dress this way, you have to shave this way, you have to relate to each other in a particular way. It goes pretty deep, intrudes pretty deep into the particulars of our lives and tells us how to live, and then it tells us what punishment to give for what offenses and how to get mercy for the offenses that otherwise would kill you and so on. But it's pretty much a governmental structure, a social structure that it has revealed there. So the Theonomist says, God revealed it, it's in the Bible, the Bible's the Word of God, what else do you need except to recognize that we ought to take the Mosaic Covenant and have the Mosaic Covenant at least inform the way we are structured in American society. On the one hand, on the other hand, probably everybody in this room, you look at that and you go, everything in me says that there would be something inappropriate about that. Stoning people for blaspheming God? That'd be a lot of dead people. And so there's something doesn't seem right about that on the one hand. On the other hand, we're set up to feel the compelling force of that argument. God revealed it. This is God's idea. He revealed it to his people Israel. He encoded it in the scripture in the Bible. The Word of God itself teaches this. How can we resist it? How can we not think that that's the right, godly, biblical way to do government? So we have to deal with the whole question of the Mosaic Covenant on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you do have a passage in the book of Romans where Paul lays out, albeit very briefly, but what looks to be kind of his own homespun, maybe unsophisticated theory of government there. There's an apostle inspired by God and put in the Bible itself some thoughts, some reflections on the nature and role of government. So how can we ignore that? So I want to look at both those passages just briefly, but in the back of my thinking is to answer that question. Does either element in the Bible suggest that there is a right, godly, righteous, just, biblical way to do government? Or the alternative is God doesn't really much care how we do government, how we structure the government. He's more concerned about what kind of people we are, no matter what government we're in. I mean, that would be the other direction to go, is that God isn't really concerned about the kind of government. God has worked with people in slavery. God has worked with people in a monarchy. God has worked with people as serfs in Russia. God has worked with people in democracies. God has worked with people under socialism. God doesn't seem to really have much concern about what kind of governmental structure you find yourself in. His priorities are different. His priorities are to reach into the individual, personal, human heart and draw people to himself, and he really doesn't much care about government. So though that's the question, is how do we sort all that stuff out? Well, one of the fundamental and key questions that we have to ask, coming back to the Mosaic Covenant now and what role the Mosaic Covenant plays, is how are we going to understand the Bible? What is the Bible and what is it for? I think the reason theonomy gets as much traction as it does and seems so compelling to some people and so hard for the rest of us to answer is because we all have a shared assumption that I think is a fallacious assumption. And that shared assumption is that the purpose of the Bible is to be some kind of, and I'm groping for words here, but some kind of answer book, some kind of instruction manual that God has given us for how to do human existence. I mean, some people take that to the extreme, and if you go to Christian bookstores, you'll find books on the biblical way to do business, the biblical way to do parenting, the biblical way to do marriage, the biblical way to do plumbing, the biblical way to do, and it can go on and on and on. The attitude behind that is, here we are thrown into the existence with all kinds of problems to solve and projects to engage in, and there's a right way and a wrong way to do everything, and the purpose of the Bible was to tell us the right way to do anything and everything. Now, some people take that more extreme than others, but all of us in Christian culture, one way or the other, have probably been enculturated into answering the question, what is the Bible, as, well, it's the answer to the question, how should we live our lives? I want to maintain that that's a fallacy. That's wrong. That's not what the Bible is. That rather, the primary purpose of the Bible is to tell us a story. It's a story that illuminates our life. It's a story that explains the meaning of our existence. It's a story that's very instructive. It's a story that gives us wisdom. But when all is said and done, what it does is tell us a story. Not give us instructions for how to do things, but it tells us a story about what God, our Creator, is doing. And that, the ramifications of that, I would argue, in the end are huge, recognizing the difference between seeing the Bible the one way rather than the other. If you see it as an instruction manual, then how do you resist the argument, the Mosaic Covenant is there in the Bible telling the Jews how to do government? Duh. That's how we're supposed to do government then. And it's almost irresistible. But if it's a story, that's a different matter. And that I want to reinterpret the Mosaic Covenant in the light of the Bible that's telling us a story, and I think we get a different perspective on that. So what is this story? It's a story that God is telling us about and through a particular people group, the people of Israel. It starts with Abraham. You know, after there's the flood, and after you get population growth going after the flood a little bit better, then along comes God breaking into history by revealing himself to this man named Abraham. And he reveals himself and makes some promises to Abraham and tells him, here's how history is going to go down now, Abraham. I'm going to bless you as an individual, but also, I'm going to bless a whole boatload of people by virtue of them identifying with you and being a part of your metaphorical family. Your metaphorical children are going to receive the same blessing that I'm going to bless you with. And the rest of human history is going to be the outworking drama of who I'm going to bless and how I'm going to bless them. And human history then is just the story of God's purposes being fulfilled in the lives of unique individuals from all the different people groups of all over the world how God has broken into history and has granted a unique blessing to them that started with a promise that he made to this man, Abraham. But there's another prong to that story. It's not just this promise of a blessing that he's going to give to them, but he also makes a promise about Abraham's descendants. And now when you fill out the picture, you begin to realize these descendants are not just metaphorical descendants. These are literal, physical, ethnic descendants of Abraham. That the ethnic descendants of Abraham are also going to be given a special role, a special place, a special blessing, a special privilege, but also a special responsibility in human history. And what is it that he promises them? Fundamentally, two things. I've got a piece of real estate. I'm going to give it to your descendants, Abraham. I'm going to give this real estate to them. And I am going to plant them in the land where I will be their God and they will be my people. And we're going to do this dance now for a number of years where I'm going to pursue them and they're going to reject me. I'm going to chastise them. I'm going to reproach them and discipline them. And they're still going to be hard-hearted and stiff-necked and going to resist me. But in the end, I'm going to win because I'm going to circumcise their hearts. I'm going to bring them back to the land. I'm going to write my covenant on their hearts. And in that day, they will be my people and I will be their God. Well, as the story unfolds, he makes that promise to Abraham. He repeats that promise to Isaac. He repeats that promise. He repeats that promise to... Okay. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob each get the promise. It gets repeated to them. And then you have silence. God doesn't do nothing for, and I never remember if it's 300 or 400 years, but 300 to 400 years, he really doesn't do anything. The people of Abraham end up journeying down to Egypt. They get enslaved and put in captivity in Egypt and just become the slave class to the Egyptians. And there they suffer in slavery. And then all of a sudden, God comes and reveals himself to this man, Moses, and he says to Moses, I'm here. I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And in the passage that you read, he said, now, your fathers, they knew me as El Shaddai, but they didn't know me as Yahweh, Moses. But I'm the same God. I'm the same one. I'm the same one that the fathers knew as El Shaddai. My name, actually, you should know me as Yahweh, and you will always know me as Yahweh. But I made a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I'm here now to fulfill that. So here's what I want you to do, Moses. I want you to go into the land. I want you to ask Pharaoh to let my people go. Bring them out here into the wilderness where I'm going to make a covenant with them. And I'm going to be their God, and they're going to be my people. And I hope you noticed in Deuteronomy how often that comes up. I'm going to be their God. Well, that goes all the way back to Abraham. That's exactly what he promised he was going to do with Abraham's seed. So you can't remove the Mosaic covenant from the context of the promise that he had made several hundred years earlier to Abraham. That's what it's all about. So how are we to understand the Mosaic covenant? The Mosaic covenant is God coming along and basically making a contract, a covenant with Israel, defining the terms of the relationship. I mean, what does it mean to be the people of God? Well, the Mosaic covenant spells it out. The Mosaic covenant says, if you're going to be my people, this is how you're going to conduct yourselves. You are... As individuals and as a society, you are going to follow these ordinances and statutes and judgments and commandments that I'm giving you this day. And people are going to know that I am your God and that you are by my people by your obedience to and your conformity to these requirements that are in the covenant. By the same token, what does it mean for God to be the God of Israel? Well, he spells it out in the covenant. I mean, isn't that interesting that the Mosaic covenant is not just a one-way, here's what you are to do. I am God. I'm the judge. Here's what you must do. The covenant also is filled with what God is going to do for them. I'm going to bring you into the land. I'm going to prosper you. I'm going to protect you from your enemies. I'm going to give you Shabbat, rest from your enemies, and right on down the line. Exactly what any polytheist in the ancient world would have expected of their God. They expect of their God that their God is going to be the source of their protection, safety, and prosperity. So God promises that, and what he requires of them is that they meet the terms of this covenant. So, as such, we have to understand the Mosaic Covenant in the context of that drama, in the context of that narrative, and what that narrative is all about. And I haven't mentioned yet, but I think in the end, what that narrative is all about is Israel becomes a foil. The people of Israel become a foil to reflect back to anyone who will watch the drama and watch the dance between them, to reflect the incredible faithfulness of God to his word, to his promises, to his commitments. Because before this drama is over, and I would argue the drama is not over, it is still an ongoing drama in human history today, but before the drama is over, God's faithfulness is going to have endured for thousands of years. After thousands of years of his chosen people, the ethnic group, the Jews, being stiff-necked and stubborn and rebuffing him and ignoring him and telling him to get lost, God is nevertheless going to be faithful to his commitment to them. And part of the commitment he made to them is, though you rebuff me, I'm going to have you anyway. Though you reject me, I will embrace you anyway. Though you will not make me your God, you are going to be my people. That's what he's promised them. And after thousands of years, when all is said and done, we are going to see the faithfulness of God played out as he circumcises their hearts, writes his law on their heart, gives them a spirit, a subjective desire, and sincere commitment to keep his covenant, and they become a godly people, a holy nation, as the prophets, as Moses called it, a nation of priests. As they fulfill that and become that nation, we are going to see something in human history that has never been seen in any other ethnic group anywhere in all the rest of human history. And that unique fulfillment of that promise will be a striking theme reaching its resolution in human history. So, that being the case, notice then what a mistake it would be for any Gentile nation or any Gentile ethnic group to take the promises that he made to Israel, the people of Abraham, and apply it to themselves. God hasn't promised me and my kind nothing. Nothing of the sort. The only thing that's ever been promised to Gentiles like me is that some of us as individuals are going to be culled out from our various people groups and grafted into these promises such that we become a part of the larger family of God that will go into eternity. That's the only thing that's ever been promised to us. But never has God promised an ethnic group, I'm going to give you a piece of real estate, and I'm going to protect you there, and I'm going to prosper you there, and I'm going to rule in righteousness over you, and you will be a righteous people, living in righteousness, dealing with each other in righteousness, and loving me and honoring me all your days. Never has that promise been made to us. But that's the context of the Mosaic Covenant. That's the context in which it makes sense at all. I love this phrase. I heard a speech by Marvin Olasky once, and he described Israel as an experiment in holiness. And I think that's exactly right, that here's this historical experiment where God is going to put in the test tube for all of us to look at the results at the end of history. What was it like for a bunch of sinners whose lives were committed to pursuing and honoring God to live together? I think at the end of history we will have seen that experiment played out. A holy people, a holy nation, organized itself in their submission to and love for God. But nowhere else has that ever happened. As much as some of the, and I will call it a mythology, but don't take that too seriously. But some of the mythology that sometimes we like to impose is that America is a Christian nation. Well, not really. We're not a Christian nation in the way that Israel is going to be a holy nation when God's promises finally get fulfilled and kept. Because never can we say of America that every last man, woman, and child made it their commitment to know and love their Creator and lived with one another in the kind of righteousness and justice that is required of people who are seeking to know and love God. That's never happened in American history, and it ain't never going to happen. But that is what's going to happen one day in Israel. Every last man, woman, child, and an animal and pet in the household is going to seek to know and love and honor their God. That's a Christian nation, I mean, in the sense in which we mean it. We have never been that. We never will be that. Instead, and I think arguably this is true, we don't have scriptural support for this, but if you just read history and what went down, it looks to me like God also did a unique experiment in America. And that the American experiment is an experiment in freedom. Okay, now let's take a bunch of sinners and let's give them true political freedom and let's watch and see what happens. And I think there's no question but what that experiment in the end has to be a failed experiment. Because what do human beings do in their freedom? They ultimately self-destruct. Because they are rebels against their Creator, and where else can that rebellious, sinful energy go except ultimately in destroying our whole relationship with each other? The very, very interesting thing, I mean, just if you were to go out on the street and interview people and ask them what their concept of freedom is, when this country was founded, they'd have one concept of freedom. The concept of freedom people have out there today is freedom means I don't have any restraints. I can live any old way I want to. I don't think you ever would have got that answer in the first generation of Americans. No, of course you can't live any old way you want to. You've got God to answer to. You have morality to answer to. You have truth to answer to. Of course there are restraints on you, but I don't have no king telling me what I can and can't do. That's what they meant by freedom. But we have... In our sinfulness and our rebellion, we've taken that freedom and said, freedom? Yeah, okay. And we morphed it and redefined it to where we have it today. I have no restraints. I can live any old way I want to. And if I don't like the way God made me, I have the freedom to try to do everything I can to be other than the way God made me or whatever. Because isn't that freedom? No, that's rebellion is what it is. And the experiment in freedom is in the end, the net result of that experiment is going to have been to show us that even if you grant people their freedom, they will end up reflecting their sinfulness, their depravity, and their rebellion against God. So in the end, I don't see how in the final outcome of the American experiment cannot possibly end in anything other than failure. Just hope it's later and not sooner. So, all that's to say, the purpose of the Mosaic Covenant was a unique event in the network of narrative stories that combine to make human history. And therefore, it does not automatically apply to America at all. That is, the burden of proof is to show in what respect the Mosaic Covenant has any relevance to us, not the other way around. But see, we are set up by our understanding of the nature of the Bible. The Bible's an instruction book that tells all of us, no matter where we are in history, how to live our lives. That assumption sets us up to flip the burden of proof the other way. The Mosaic Covenant should be kept until you can prove to me it shouldn't. And I think actually understanding the real nature of the Bible flips the burden of proof the other way. If you want to apply some aspect of the Mosaic Covenant, you have to show me by what rationale that's relevant. Now, we can talk about that in a second if you want. But let me then move over to Romans. What we find in Romans, I think, is also greatly misunderstood because we don't understand the historical context in which it was written. This is a great example of what Ron was talking about the other day when he talked about how inappropriate it is to go to the Bible looking for answers to my questions. The important thing in understanding the Bible is I have to go to the Bible understanding what was the question that was in the forefront of the author's mind, and it's in the forefront of his mind because it's the question in the background in his reader's mind. That's what we have to understand. Because if we don't understand that, then we're not understanding what the Bible's saying. I first encountered Romans 13 in the midst of the Vietnam War. And I was in college, and all the Christians around me were wrestling with the question of what should be my response as a Christian to whether or not I'm willing to go to war at all, willing to go into this particular war, and all the moral muddle that brought into our lives. And people would always go to Romans 13 for the answer to that. So notice my question is not, well, so my question as I approach it in the middle of the Vietnam War is, do I have to obey the government? Must I, as a Christian, necessarily obey the government? Or is it possible to disobey the government and still have that be morally valid? The question in Paul's day is not, can a holy individual disobey the government? Am I getting that right? Yeah. His question was, can a holy person obey the government? Completely the inverse. The debate going on in the time of Jesus and Paul among the Jews was, here are the Jews, the people of God, who are to have no other God except Yahweh and to serve no other God but Yahweh and be loyal to him and him alone. And now they have this Roman army come in and occupy them, claiming that their Caesar is God, and you owe your allegiance to Caesar. And one way you show your allegiance to Caesar is you pay us taxes. Well, among the Jews, the default position would be, I mean, the knee-jerk response would be, I cannot pay taxes to Caesar. I would be dishonoring and disloyal to Yahweh if I paid taxes to Caesar. So obedience to the government seems unthinkable at the outset from the get-go to them. This is a godless, pagan, heathen ruler. How on earth can I possibly pay taxes to him and not be betraying my loyalty to Yahweh? And they broke up into different factions. The zealots said, no way do you pay taxes to Caesar, and in fact, we need to take up arms and resist him militarily. The Pharisees held their noses, agreeing that it was an obnoxious thing to do, but it's expedient, so we pay taxes to Caesar, but we don't like it. The Herodians paid taxes to Caesar and liked it because he gave them positions in the government, and they got fat salaries out of it. So you had the Herodians, the Pharisees, the Zealots, and then different factions of the Zealots. When they come to Jesus and ask him, should we be paying taxes to Caesar, they're trying to get him to weigh in on that particular social political issue within Judaism. I think Jesus' answer is identical to Paul's answer. They answer it in exactly the same way. And fundamentally, the way both Jesus and Paul finesse it is to recognize what you're not understanding. The fallacy in Jewish thinking in our days is to think that a heathen governor, by virtue of his military power and strength and ascendancy, is somehow not a servant of Yahweh. That's what you're not understanding. Why is it that we can feel the freedom to pay taxes to Caesar? Because we know and understand that God is so powerful that in his providence, Caesar wouldn't be sitting in his throne in Rome if God didn't want him there. I'm not dishonoring God by paying taxes to the funky little servant that he happens to have put in power in Rome right now. I'm not honoring him above God because I understand that any semblance of power that Caesar has comes from God. I know that. I understand that. So I'm not betraying him by paying the taxes that Caesar asks of me. So by reframing their perspective, both Jesus and Paul are giving the perspective from which they can know and understand that it is not being unholy, ungodly, unrighteous, and disloyal if they go ahead and pay their taxes. But he's not weighing in on the question that I wanted the answer to. Well, is there any possibility at all that I could disobey Caesar? I think both Jesus and Paul would kind of cock their eyes and go, are you kidding me? Any possibility at all? Of course you have to disobey Caesar if Caesar tells you to disobey God. I mean, that's a no-brainer to them. They were coming from the other perspective. They were saying, is there any possibility at all that we could actually obey Caesar sometimes? And they're saying, yeah, if you take the right perspective, then sure, you can obey Caesar sometimes. But they were taking it for granted that there may come times when you have to disobey Caesar. Caesar does not trump God. And if God commands you, and if obedience to God requires one thing, Caesar has no right to prevent you from obeying your God. So that's a no-brainer. So, in the course of answering that question in Romans 13, Paul does say some really interesting things about the role of Caesar. Why does God put people like Caesar, give them the power that he gives them? And he basically seems to give a very, very simple answer to that. His role is to punish evil and to reward good. Now, of course, it is such a simple answer that it's subject to misinterpretation. It's really important to understand the context, or we're going to misunderstand what he's saying. The context is the role of governing authority. The coercive power of government is given by God to certain people to what end? To punish evil and to reward good. Well, it seems to me, we can talk about this, but it seems to me that can't possibly be true goodness and true evil in the sense that Jesus and the apostles are concerned about all the time, that we come to recognize the deep, inner, basic, fundamental, foundational depravity of the human heart, of the human being, and calling us to make commitments of our heart to a different vision for what it means to be a human being, to be committed to good, to be committed to resist evil in our lives. All that's very subjective, very personal, and is very inward and goes very deep within a person. It's not the government's job to peer into my soul and sort out what's genuine and what's hypocritical, what's truly good and what isn't good, and punish me or reward me for that. That's a personal journey, and government has no business talking about that. But there does come a point where good and evil have an impact at a societal level. And I think that's what Paul is talking about. The government's job is to punish social evil and to reward social good. And there Paul thinks that Caesar plays a legitimate function. Godless and heathen though he may be, even godless heathens can recognize the difference between antisocial, subversive behavior to society and behavior that is constructive to society and is not antisocial, is promoting the social good. And I think that's Paul's very simple, straightforward theory of government. The trick for us today, of course, becomes how do we define when an evil stops being merely a personal evil and becomes a societal evil? Where do you draw that line? I think that becomes very, very difficult. And that's the biggest challenge to us as Christians today in our particular context, in our particular state in history. How where are we going to draw that line? And as best I can know, I think there's room for disagreement about that. The Bible doesn't really spell that out. It kind of leaves it to us to discern the times and discern our place in history and decide about that. Okay, the only other thing I had to talk about would be what exactly are the different kinds of commands in the Mosaic Covenant, but I think I'll leave that now, leave it for your questions unless you ask me about that and want me to go down that road. So questions. And the question and answer is 3:40. So questions on this for the next 10 minutes or so, and then we'll take a break and have the general question and answer.
Let's say that a faction came into power of theonomists who were trying to get laws passed where we would stone blasphemers. Mm-hmm. Would we have an obligation to support them or resist them?
Yeah, when you put it that way, I stumble over it. Well, certainly not to support them. I mean that's the easy part for me. No, we have no obligation to support them. I would certainly oppose what they're doing. Would that opposition translate into political action? That, you know, that's the dilemma of this whole week, is what really ought we to do? Is it where I was left after Elul's reading is what's really challenging about Elul's reading to me is all of my instincts as an American says I need to be a part of the group that goes back in and takes over the reins of government because we're headed the wrong direction, so we need to take back the reins of government away from the governmental statists that want to take over the government in order that we can get back to the kind of freedom that America was founded on. That's my knee-jerk reaction. What Elul, it seems to me, is saying instead is we need to do an end run around the government, and we really basically need to establish countercultures, and that those countercultures will exist in tension to the government and ultimately hold the government answerable to our voices and our ideas and our values, and in that way we'll provide a check on the government. So the question is, should my energy be put into creating a counterculture, or should my energy be put into taking over the reins of government? And I don't know. So if it were not a secular, socialist, statist kind of an agenda, but were a Christian Taliban agenda instead, I'd have the same dilemma. I wouldn't support it. There's no question that I wouldn't be for it. But how do you fight it? Do you fight it by ripping the reins of power out of their hands, or do you oppose it by creating a counterculture?
If that's the case, certainly there were unbelievers amongst the Israelites. If they had implemented the law, that law as God had required them to or commanded them to, there would have been a lot of people killed as a result. Who yeah. probably weren't killed because of Israel's disobedience. Mm-hmm. Why was their situation different? Well, in that particular regard, why was their priority so much different than ours, that God was commanding them to do something that would be repugnant to us?
Well, okay. Notice that in the drama of God's dealing with history, from the get-go, they disobey the covenant. They don't keep it, much to the survival of many of the people of Israel that otherwise would have been executed if they had actually kept it. So they don't actually obey the covenant until some future time in history. But notice that what God predicts, the time when they obey the covenant also happens to coincide with a miraculous act of God to circumcise their hearts, to write to his law in their heart. And as Paul quotes Joel, I think, in Romans, and thus all Israel will be saved. And he seems to be, Joel seems to be foreseeing a day when every old men will dream dreams, young men will do something else, will prophesy. I mean, he goes down the whole list. Everybody among the people of God will turn their hearts to God and will obey him and will honor him and know him. Well, the time when they keep the covenant is a time when nobody's breaking the covenant, so there aren't a lot of stonings going on, if any. You see what, you following me?
Yeah.
Because God is sanctifying the people, they are people who are keeping the covenant, and because they are keeping the covenant, there's no occasion to stone the outrageous, high-handed rebels against the covenant, because they don't exist. Why is God doing that in Israel and not us? Just because it's the unique little experiment that he wants to do in and through and around that ethnic group. Just as it would be, okay, it's not inhumane to require of sanctified people that they be sanctified. It would be inhumane to ask of unsanctified Americans, be sanctified or we're going to stone you. That would be inhumane. But in the day when the covenant actually gets fulfilled, it happens that it won't be inhumane because you're not requiring of the people of Israel anything that God has not supplied, their sanctification.
So you see that the covenant, the Mosaic law, is not really being effective until some future date.
Our future, exactly. It's always been standing there as a perpetual covenant that God has made with his people, but they have perpetually not been interested. And so all of history is God waiting patiently and pursuing them. And in the final end, he promises to catch them.
Okay. On the lines of the experiment idea, you were saying that the American experiment is an experiment in freedom. It sounded like you were saying that it was a unique experiment in freedom. How would you see it as unique compared to the antediluvian freedom where there was no law essentially in the world, and people did pretty much what they wanted with almost no restriction?
Right. That's a good question. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know what their governmental structure was.
Or if there was one.
Or if there was one, yeah. So, I think what we would find is that the way we have ordered ourselves and organized ourselves and the whole Federalist Papers, I don't think they had the Federalist Papers that were...
I get the impression from Genesis 6 that their governmental structure was the biggest and strongest got his way.
Exactly. That's my impression, what he calls the Nephilim. Were around in life. I think you had heroic strongmen who kept the order.
This is just to satisfy my curiosity. So when you were originally coming to this that verse and looking for, can I get out of, is there any way I can get out of obeying the government? What conclusion did you come to then, and then how long did it take for you to change your mind if you did?
Well, I wasn't a very good child of my generation. Because of my assumptions, I felt the power of that verse telling me I had no right to disobey the government. Now, I would no longer have that perspective as a general principle. And as much as I wrestled with the question of Vietnam, it always seemed compelling to me that as bad as however bad our interference in Vietnam might be, the alternative was worse. And that always seemed the case to me. And so I was always basically secretly pro-war, even though you didn't talk about it much back in those days. I mean, I don't, pro-war sounds awful. I'm not pro-war, but I thought it was the necessary evil of that time in history. Interestingly, I read an autobiography by David Horowitz. David Horowitz is now considered a neoconservative. He's not a social conservative by any means, but sort of an economic conservative. Back in the 60s, he was across the bay in Berkeley. He was the editor of Ramparts magazine, and any of you from those days know Ramparts magazine. Ramparts magazine was the voice of the new left. And his autobiography was interesting because his background sounded just like mine, except where I would say Baptist, you plug in communist for him, and then we had the same childhood. He went off to communist camp, communist summer camp, you know. I just went off to Baptist summer camp. But he was raised religiously a communist, and then when he entered into his teens and 20s, became one of the leaders of the new left. His conversion experience from neo-Marxism to neoconservatism happened because in the pages of Ramparts magazine, he called Nixon a big fat liar, because Nixon was saying that if we pull out of Vietnam, it's going to be a bloodbath. And Horowitz went in print saying Nixon is a big fat liar, that will never happen in a million years. And when it happened, just as Nixon said, his whole world was blown apart. Because he was very sincere in his values and his perspectives. He just didn't get the dynamics at play in socialism that lead to the kind of murderous, coercive violence that you always see in any of the leftist revolutions. He just didn't get that part. And when it actually came to pass, he had to rethink his whole political theory. And he became a neoconservative. Why was that relevant? It was somehow relevant once upon a time. Okay. Oh, yes. About the meaning of the passage? Not until many, many years later, when I was finally figuring out Romans and I realized that the context matters, and I figured out what he was doing. Yeah. And interestingly, no longer did I have a question that I was bringing to the text. When I stopped asking the text to answer my questions and then just tried to figure out the text, that changes things.
Thank you, Jack. As you're describing the culture and then the counterculture, in current times, would you characterize the Tea Party movement in its many perturbations? I know there's a lot of differences, but that would be the type of counterculture movement that you're using? Would it would be an example of that in your description?
That was talking about?
Yes.
I don't know, because I'm not sure if I understand exactly what Alul envisions. What's interesting is several really important thinkers seem to be echoing the same kind of thing. We read a book in our curriculum by Alistair MacIntyre called After Virtue, and his last chapter, he's talked about the absolute complete decay of moral reasoning and moral life in American in Western culture and American culture. And so he says, so where do we go from here? And you need to help me, Tim. But he ends it by saying, his last line, I think, is, we're waiting for a new Saint Benedict. And what he means by that is, with the collapse of the Roman Empire, what happened? Monasteries were born. Saint Benedict was the first one to kind of give order and structure to the monastic life. And in the monastic life, basically you had people joining together in community, together looking for, searching for, and defining together what it means to live out human existence and pursue the good life and pursue the good. They're in community together, they're working that out and hammering that out together. So the state had collapsed, culture had collapsed, civilization had collapsed. So what did they do? They just formed little local communities that began the process once again of reaching a vision and an understanding of how we as human beings should live together. And he thinks that the moral, at least at the end of that book, he thought that our moral understanding, our moral knowledge was so corrupted and fallen apart and so failed that we really, our only hope is to once again band into those small communities and go down that path once again together in communities. You want to add to that? Is that?
Well, I understand the end of the book. There's another quote that I think of when I think about that McIntyre quote, the church historian that said, no matter what you think about monasticism, it at least had the effect of impressing the sense of the ineffable of God's existence on the West. Even if you didn't like the way they were going about things, if you didn't like all the entrapments of it, it still had that effect. And I think that's kind of what McIntyre's thinking also.
Mm-hmm. And I that's what I sort of saw Elul saying. So the thing about the Tea Party movement that makes me hesitate is I don't think it's organized. It's just a reflex. It's a reflex of people who are in a sense deeply American, who realize as much as a vision of society that is contrary to the founder's vision of what it means to live together as an American people, as much as that has been eroding, we've crossed a line here that has created a reaction, a reflex. And I'm not sure that the Tea Party at this point is too much more than just a reflex response to that. We'll see what comes from it. But it could very well be that what will come from it is something a little bit more organized, a little bit more ordered that really we could call a counterculture. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if that results.
Well, that's what I was trying to determine, because in many ways I kept looking at it and I kept saying, this really isn't a counterculture. What this is the culture finally having a voice and exercising it. But with the illusion of information, it's so hard for me to really grab a hold of what is our culture right now. And so I'm trying to determine, does the Tea Party represent truly what our culture is? Mm-hmm. So thank you. You've helped me.
Yeah, exactly. It came up in our discussion group. The Tea Party is a great example, or how the Tea Party is being managed by the media and government and so on, is a great example of what Elul was talking about. Because notice that it doesn't really matter what the actual facts are about this reflex reaction by people. It's going to get packaged by the media, and we're going to be given a picture. They're a bunch of racists, or they're a bunch of gun-toting paranoids, or whatever. But what is being handed back to us is an image, and respond to the image. You know, well, neither of those images is a very pretty image, but it's the people in power attempting to control the effect and the impact of that reflex reaction by a whole segment of America, I think. Okay. Maybe one more, just one more question, and then we'll take a break.
So if we're going to do what Elul is saying and try to make small countercultures and associations to resist the government, and what we're resisting...
Well, excuse me, just a second.
Okay.
I don't know that he's necessarily saying to resist the government.
Okay.
I think that was David's point when the left organizes to resist the government. I think what Elul is saying is they're organizing to ignore the government.
Okay. I misunderstood, and that was my question, is if we're trying to resist the government doing things that we don't think government ought to do, so politicizing areas of life which ought not to be politicized, we can't resist the government without actually using politics to do it.
Exactly.
So it's kind of self-contradictory. But
exactly.
If what we're doing is saying we're not going to ask, as Elul says, we must not ask the government for anything. If we have a need, we organize and take care of it ourselves.
Yeah.
So
we
ignore
just
the government.
Totally do an end run around the government, saying, you play your game, we've got a life to live. And we're going to live our lives, and as we meet problems, we will organize, and we will spontaneously organize to solve our problems. And we don't need your help. We don't want your help. We're not looking for your help. I think that's what he's saying.
So in a sense, that's already happening with education. We've got homeschools,
yeah.
Schools that will not take government support in order to retain their independence and be able to do what they want to do.
Yeah. I mean, it is possible that governments don't like you ignoring them and will insist on forcing you to resist. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, we'll take a break in 5 minutes. Okay.